Session number 8337, Reel 7.
General Graham, Reel 7. Three British officers. Now, due to leave, sickness or wounds, invariably only two British officers actually were on the ground at one time with the company. And so the companies tended to operate in two halves, with one British Saab commanding and leading each half. And this British officer, of course, because he was the only chap in the company who could do so, had to do all the radio instructions to the supporting artillery, to the mortars, and to the supporting aircraft, and occasionally naval vessels. They were really very busy and very brave, and they led from the front. And Britain can be proud of them. But another point I must make is that although the forces in Dhofar outnumbered and outgunned were fighting a pretty violent war. For example, in some of the battles, a troop of artillery would fire in an afternoon more shell than the whole of Rhine Army fires in a year in peacetime in Germany. There was a lot of fighting and many casualties, particularly on the enemy. The whole thing had to be run on the basis of peacetime accounting. Every penny and every round had to be accounted for. And so when these young officers had come off the battlefield from leading their men, they then had to get down to the business of administering their companies and training them and fathering them as if it was a peacetime routine experience in Aldershot. And not only was there trouble in Dhofar, the enemy threatening the Sultanate from Aden belonged to an organisation known as PFLOAG, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Oman and the Arabian Gulf, PFLOAG. But established much longer ago, but hitherto far less effective, was another organisation known as NDFLOAG, the National Democratic Front for the Liberation of Oman and the Arabian Gulf. Now, this outfit was based in the northern Gulf states, chiefly in Iraq. And that was comprised of Omanis who had fled to better their lives from the Oman of Sultan's side and been recruited by all sorts of people, mostly communist or extreme leftist, in the northern Gulf states in that part of the world. And they had mounted one or two pretty wet sort of attempts to get back in and stir up revolt in the northern part of Oman while all this performance was going on all these years down in the south, 800 miles away down in Dhofar. This revolutionary activity in the central and northern Oman, however, came to a head in the middle of June 1970. When out of the blue, various gangs, very well armed and extremely well financed, of young men attacked two of our armed forces' encampments in the general area of the Jebel Akhtar. Well, the enemy weren't very good, and God was very good to us. All I can say is that we and the forces under me responded very well. And by the end of the month, every single member of those gangs had been killed or taken prisoner. And furthermore, their links with subversive organizations in Matra and Muscat and the big towns on the coast had been disclosed. But of course, it became perfectly plain that we'd escaped a catastrophe in the north by hair's breadth. And indeed, the plan was, so I was told later by a leading enemy organizer, that there should have been a series of incidents well separated over this great expanse of northern and central Oman, which would have caused the armed forces under its British officers to go off in penny packets, you know, a small party to each incident. Whereupon, on a given signal, some of the soldiers who had been briefed beforehand would have murdered their British officers and paralysed the force. The ruler then would have fallen. But it didn't work out like that, because the enemy, very stupidly, to gain experience, went and put into the gangs which attacked the first two targets the leaders of all the other groups. And because we caught up with them and scuppered them, the leaders never got back to the other groups. But what we did find, of course, was that a vast numbers of arms and explosives and other munitions had been cached over the previous years throughout the country and were there, concealed. And there was a lot of, if you like, leaderless dissidents around. And so our eyes, the eyes of the military, could not be wholly directed towards Dhofar, serious though that problem was, because we had the bulk of the country still to look after. So this was a problem which the young Sultan had to grasp as soon as he came to the throne, and he did it. He offered an amnesty period in which people had to hand in the weapons, you know, which they had got illegally in their revolutionary guise, and in exchange he'd given both a pardon and a large sum of money. Well, this had some effect, but the army, of course, had to do the whole thing, because there was no police in the country. There were only 5 miles of road. There was only one hospital, and there was only one school. The only organisation in the Sultanate, again I say, a country the size of the United Kingdom, the only organisation which could actually cope with all the problems and had the means and the discipline and the, if you like, skills to do it, were the armed forces. It was the only cohesive organisation in this large country.
Did the offer of amnesty work?
In part, yes. It didn't in Dhofar. In Dhofar, the Sultan, Qaboos, after he came to the throne, imposed a period of operational restraint. This meant that the Desert Regiment, my force down there, Desert Regiment Group, and the artillery and the Air Force, were not allowed actually to engage in offensive operations on the Jebel. They could continue to do defensive operations in case they were attacked. But it was imposed to give the Jabali, the people up top, an opportunity to think about the situation and lay down their arms and come in. But it didn't work. And it didn't work for two reasons. The first is that the communists had no intention of letting it work. And the threat of reprisals against the families of those people who did come down from the hill was sufficient to keep most of Bali sitting there. Secondly, I talked about broadcasting by radio and dropping leaflets. We set up a radio station in Salalah, and we had to try and infiltrate to the Jabali transistor sets. I mean, none of these things existed before, never been heard of. We had to start from scratch, and we had to design on pieces of paper and drop from aircraft leaflets. Well, in fact, good though they were, the number of people who could actually be affected or influenced by a leaflet or a broadcast was tiny, particularly as their source of information came from Radio Aden, which was a very powerful broadcaster, of course manned by the communists and wholly in support of the communist revolutionaries. That is where the Jabali information came from. And indeed, it took many months before all the Jabalis could even be persuaded that the ruler had changed. And so there was an initial period when we were not actually engaging the enemy offensively in his strongholds on the mountains, but he continued to attack us and strengthen his position. And that lasted to about the end of the year.
Why was it that you had all these Baluchis in the force?
Two reasons. Firstly, the Omani was not all that keen on volunteering in adequate numbers to become a soldier in the service of Sultan Said. I mean, the conditions of service, the rates of pay, were not all that good. And, of course, as the Dhofar War escalated, the hazards of such a career was a bit off-putting. And the other thing is that, I mean, there simply wasn't the population, that the manpower wasn't there to do it in sufficient quantities. Therefore, the Sultan turned to the Baluch to do it for him. Now, it's a very interesting thing that an area of what is now Pakistan, or to be more precise, Baluchistan, or to be more precise still, Gwadar, used to be under the rule of the Sultan of Muscat and Oman. But when Pakistan was created by the British at the time of Indian independence, Gwadar was bought off Muscat by the Pakistan government. But because of the incipient unemployment conditions in Pakistan, the Sultan of Oman was still allowed to recruit soldiers from those citizens, if you like, of Pakistan.
How did you find the Baluchis as compared with the Omanis?
Both had admirable qualities. They were, however, quite different. And hitherto I've always said, in answer to this question, that I can best explain the difference as follows. If I picked up a hammer to hit a Baluch on the head, it would probably be tomorrow before he realized I'd done it. If I picked up a hammer to hit an Omani or an Arab on the head, he would have known yesterday I was going to do it. The former, solid, stolid, phlegmatic, not easily moved. The latter, the Omani Arab, dynamic, imaginative, a bit of a chatterbox, proud, very with it. Now, the combination of these two qualities in a rifle section of 10 men, I think, had great profit. Because, you see, you had your Arab, observant, quick-witted, on the QT, alert for something. But when it came to a moment of stress or danger, possibly rather erratic, bloody awful marksmanship, I might say, on both sides, neither side could shoot very straight. Baluch, on the other hand, rather like the East Anglian soldier of the British infantry, traditional, you know, stolid, reliable, not easily moved.
Was there any friction between the two?
At times, there was friction. There were, before I got there, I mean, in the years preceding my appointment, some mutinies. And the mutinies, I understand, were always by Baluch units, or parties of Baluch, and almost entirely due to bad handling, bad man management by British officers. Almost entirely. I don't know of any cases where an Omani Arab unit or group mutinied. There was no great love between the two, but I can't recall a single incident on the battlefield in which an Arab let down a Baluch or Baluch an Arab, or in which either ever let down a British officer. And indeed the occasion which great bravery and great devotion was shown by both to rescuing wounded British officers and so on, numerous. Later on, however, and I'm talking now about 71, 72, when Oman started to become a rapidly developing, strong, important power under its new Sultan, with job opportunities and industry being created, I mean, the place was transformed from over 8 centuries of transformation in about 10 years. It was a marvelous experience to be there and watch it happening. Then the differences between the Omani and the Baluch heightened, and there became great feeling in Oman that no more Baluch should be recruited into the army, and no more Baluch should be brought in, if you like, into the developing civil side. because the Omanis said, this is our country and we must look after it, and the job is to pay for us and not for them. But, of course, the Sultan soon realized that we couldn't continue to fight a war, a major war down south, without a continuing flow of Baluch. Indeed, the position still is that a number of regiments are wholly Baluch in the army today, because Oman doesn't have the manpower.
You said earlier that Salalah was wired in. What exactly did you mean by that?
What I say. I mean, wired in, great belts of wire and mines. I mean, the whole town, the sea on one side, and defensive wire and patrols on the other three sides. Had to be. I mean, the enemy were only a few thousand yards away.
So rolls of barbed wire around it.
Yes. Massive wire defences.
What did you learn from the people who surrendered?
Oh, many things. Many things. Before I answer that question, I must, I think, digress and talk a little more about the role of the British Army proper. Now, I've already, in answer to one of your questions, described very briefly how the relationship between Britain and Oman developed and how after the Jebel Akhtar War the armed forces were to a certain extent subvented by the British Treasury and how British officers were seconded and allowed to contract to run the Sultan's forces. It had become by 1968-69 perfectly plain to the authorities in Muscat and in London that the communist threat, the communist presence in Dhofar, could not be overcome solely by the Sultan's forces on their own. And at that stage, Oman, Sultan's side, had no allies. The only representation in his country was one British consul and an Indian consul. Nothing else. He had no relations at all with the Arab world. So there's no question of getting help from any of them. If anything, they sided and supported his enemies, the rebels, both in central Oman and in Dhofar. The only place he could turn to was Britain. And Britain, of course, had a major interest because we still had a presence in Aden and in Bahrain and the Gulf and in the Far East. And indeed, RAF station Salalah was a very important RAF post, as was the one on the Sultanate Island of Mazira. But the British government of the time, I'm talking now about the 60s, run by Harold Wilson, would not permit British soldiers to go. They'd be back here losing cause in any event. However, after Caboose forced his father to abdicate and took over himself, the Special Air Services Regiment, or elements of it from Hereford, did come out, along with some others in small quantities, known as the British Army Training Team, to Dhofar, to help, under my command, to help deal with this communist menace. And the two great things which the Special Air Service Regiment did, which we could not do, because we were, our elastic in SAF was stretched to breaking point, was firstly provided an intelligence cell in Dhofar to enable me and my officers to have a properly conducted intelligence machinery for assessing what the enemy had, what the enemy were likely to do, and what we could best do to them. Hitherto, that intelligence cell had consisted of one young British contract captain, full stop. But these people came out with a proper cell, and by November of 70, we had got many, many facts hitherto unknown about the enemy and their habits and their leadership and their personalities and their support and everything else. And I must say it made rather grim reading, because the enemy were very strong and they had very considerable help, as I said, from the Soviet Union and from China. But, of course, as more of these people, SEPs, as the surrendered enemy personnel, as these people defected and came across to us, so our depth of knowledge of the enemy increased, and it increased by leaps and bounds. And whereas the initial people probably couldn't produce very much, because they came very largely out of pure funk, because they knew if they'd stayed up there, they'd be put to death. They came across. Later on, after some months, we were getting some really quite senior people. And I remember, for example, one quite senior officer came in, a party of three of them came in, and he brought with him all his course notebooks from his course, 6 months guerrilla training course in China. He'd had 8 months in China, 2 months on a tour of the country, and 6 months at a military training school. And he brought all these pamphlets with him when he surrendered to us, and they're now in London. And I talked to him and said, well, you know, what do you think of China? I mean, was it beneficial to you? And he said, by and large, yes, it was very interesting. And they spent a lot of money looking after us and taking us around the place, and very generous indeed, and enjoyed it. But he says, as regards the military value of the training he'd received at this anti-imperialist school, or whatever it was called, outside Peiping, no, it wasn't really very great. And he said, what I learnt from Sergeant Brown when I was a recruit at Sharjah in the Trucial Oman Scouts was far more valuable than what these Chinese have taught me, which I found rather amusing. And, of course, this raises the point that one of the difficulties we were up against in fighting the Dofaris, led by these or stimulated by these communists in Dofar, was that the Trucial Oman Scouts was an excellent gendarmerie force paid for by the British and officered by the British up in the area of Sharjah, Dubai and Ras Al Khaimah, up in the Trucial Oman States. They had a squadron, X squadron, which was composed wholly of Dofaris. Now they got the bug, and they joined in this Dofar Liberation Army. And when they went on leave from the Trucial Oman Scouts, increasingly, they never returned. They ended up on the opposite side facing us. And some of the best marksmen, some of the best mortar handlers, some of the best officers of our enemy were, in fact, people who had been trained and paid in a British formation a few hundred miles to the north of Oman. But most of those saw the lighting and came across and joined us. Now, the other great thing, of course, in addition to intelligence, which the SAS did for us in Dofar, and they deserve the utmost credit, because this was a very difficult task indeed, having recruited the Jabali, the Dofari Jabalis, who had come down, be they communist officers or just ordinary herdsmen, having recruited these people from Dofar into these firkets, they then had to train them, administer them, teach them, and lead them in battle. And they did. But of course, this was an irregular force with very little discipline, subject to all sorts of whims, initially highly unreliable. Fascinating people, bloody at times, and yet these little handfuls of sterling SAS men and officers used to deal with these tribal firkets, and out of them constructed a force without which Dofar could not have been liberated. The concept of getting these surrendered people across to us and form them into these auxiliary bands, firkets, was a factor of capital importance, paramount importance, to eventual liberation of Dofar. Because if they hadn't existed, the liberation of Dofar would have had to be done by a small number of British soldiers, the Omani Arabs, and Baluch, under British officers. Anathema to the inhabitants. These were their own people. And it worked. Eventually. But of course, we still had, even come 72, no more than a very weak brigade in Dhofar, even though the forces of the Sultanate had grown to 10,000 plus. We could only deploy in Dhofar one weak brigade. So the battalion that I found at the beginning of 70, which did so well, Desert Regiment, had in fact, by 71 and throughout 72, been expanded into a weak brigade. But a weak brigade with a little bit of air power is not sufficient to liberate a country, a very mountainous, hellishly rugged country, occupied by communists, a country the size of Wales. But it had to be done. And there was no possibility of getting any more from Britain, even though the government in London had changed from being a Labour administration to Ted Heath, Conservative. No question. Ulster was a major problem. The supply of people to go on secondment could not be guaranteed. And don't forget, secondment is entirely voluntary. Nobody in the British Army can be made to go to a place like Oman or Rhodesia or anywhere. They can only go voluntarily for secondment. And, of course, the contract people, the mercenaries, as they're sometimes referred to, those who came on contract, were very large ex-colonial policemen and so on. Now, the supply of them in England was drying up. I mean, the empire had passed. There was no longer a bottomless pit of people who liked the military life and were free to go. And so it became totally essential, come the end of 71, the beginning of 72, that Sultan Qaboos, firstly, got some international recognition, which his father never obtained, and secondly, got some physical help in terms of manpower and armament from allies. And the first thing to do was to get him some allies. Now, he was a very, very good young ruler with an excellent personality, and in quick time he established pretty close relations with King Hussein of Jordan, and their backgrounds, after all, were very similar, both Sandhurst cadets, similar age, very much akin, I think. He succeeded in smoothing the bad relations which existed between his father and the ruling family in Saudi Arabia. And so the Saudi support for the original Jebel Akhtar rebels, which I mentioned earlier, in the northern part of Oman, that all fell by the wayside. And Saudi recognized Sultan Qaboos. He got Oman accepted into the Arab League. And in late 71, he got Oman recognized by the United Nations and admitted to that organization. Now, it may surprise you that it hadn't been before, but it wasn't, because the Saudis and the others, who thought the Sultan was an improper or illegal ruler, unrepresentative ruler, would not allow this to happen. But Qaboos got all this straightened out. And at last, by the end of 71, Oman was, if you like, a country in its own right, recognized by the world community.
Did the Saudis not create any military trouble whilst you were there?
No, not while I was there. Well, I'm not sure that's right. I have no proof that the Saudis were actually behind the incidents in either Dhofar or the central Oman in the early part, in the middle of 70 that I've talked about. I have no proof the Saudis were. They might have been, and they should have been. They were still backing the rebels. But I personally have no proof that they were. It was much more Russian than Chinese at that stage. But in any case, soon after Qaboos came to the throne, he smoothed down the relationship with Saudis, and the Saudis became friends. But the chiefest friend was King Hussein, and he started to send a little bit of military support in the form of four officers who came and offered courses in Amman for our soldiers, our officers to be going to be trained. But in terms of